We are in Guantanamo and will remain there for the foreseeable future.
This is the voice of Secretary of State Dean Rusk at his news conference today. And this is John Scali, ABC State Department correspondent in Washington, with a special wrap-up of the highlights of the Secretary's meeting with the press. Some 150 newsmen were on hand as Mr. Rusk ranged over the world's hotspots, Cuba, Panama, Vietnam, Red China, and East-West relations generally. Anticipating their questions, Mr. Rusk started off with a prepared statement which was intended to refute Fidel Castro's accusations that those four Cuban fishing boats were seized illegally off the coast of Florida.
The United States Coast Guard cutter Cape Knox sighted the four Cuban vessels on February 1, trolling at approximately 19 miles west-southwest of Marquesas Cay. At 1:20 in the afternoon on February 2nd, the Coast Guard observed the four Cuban boats fishing in U.S. territorial waters at approximately 1.5 miles east-southeast of East Kai. Visibility at the time was 10 miles and the seas moderate. The boats were directed to anchor and stand by for boarding. The Cuban boats obeyed this order. When they anchored, the various vessels were between 1.5 and 1.9 miles off East Key. When the U.S. Coast Guard cutter Cape Star arrived on the scene at 7 o'clock that evening with a boarding party, the inspection of the Cuban vessels began. The inspection was carried out by only one party and it took 3 hours. The boarding and inspection was conducted in the normal manner with due regard for the welfare of the crews. Early the next morning, the Coast Guard vessels on the scene began to escort the four Cuban ships to Key West with a boarding party on the lead boat, the Lambda 33. And they arrived in Key West at 5:45 in the afternoon. The decision to take these vessels to Key West, taken following consultation with the Department of State, had as its purpose further investigation and interrogation of the boats and crews in connection with the violation of federal law. Officials of the Coast Guard and Customs and Immigration conducted the investigation and interrogation. When these were completed on the evening of February 5, the United States Coast Guard, at the official request of the appropriate authorities of the state of Florida, turned over the boats and crews to state officials for handling under state law. I wish to point out that the Coast Guard is authorized under the United States Code, upon the request of the proper authority, to utilize its personnel and facilities to assist any state to perform any activity for which such personnel and facilities are especially qualified. Federal authorities, from their investigation and interrogation, concluded that the Cuban vessels were fishing in the territorial waters of the United States contrary to Section 251 of Title 46 of the United States Code. However, as this statute contains no penalties, prosecution by federal authorities was not undertaken. As the boats and crews were also in probable violation of the laws of the state of Florida, and thus subject to prosecution by state authorities, the Coast Guard allowed the state of Florida to assume jurisdiction. This step, too, was taken in consultation with the Department of State. Two of the masters of the Cuban fishing boats have admitted to Coast Guard officials that they were knowingly fishing in United States waters. A monitored conversation between the Lambda 33 and a control station in Havana, which took place at 2:25 p.m. on February 2nd, read as follows. Havana, where are you anchored? Lambda 33, well, we're east of Tortugas. Go ahead. Havana, international waters? Lambda 33, well, no, this is national water, national water. Havana, I understand. Now, from the foregoing, it is clear that the Cuban fishing vessels knew they were fishing inside the territorial sea of the United States, and that Havana was also aware of this fact. This, plus our own knowledge of their location, completely disproves the claim of the Cuban government that the Cuban boats were in international water when apprehended. The United States government first communicated with the Cuban government on this matter on the morning of February 4th, when the Swiss ambassador in Havana presented a note from us to the Cuban foreign minister relating the facts of the case and protesting the unauthorized intrusion of the fishing vessels into United States waters in violation of international law, and requesting all necessary steps by the Cuban government to prevent a recurrence of such incidents. At 4:30 on the same day, the counselor of the Czech embassy, which represents Cuban interests in the United States, made an oral protest of the detention of the vessels and crews and requested, on behalf of the Cuban government, the release of the boats and crews. At about 11:15 a.m. of February 6th, the Cuban foreign minister handed the Swiss ambassador a note announcing that as of noon that day, the water supply to the naval base would be cut off and that the suspension of water deliveries would be maintained until the crew members of the fishing vessels were put at liberty. At 4:00 on that same afternoon, the counselor of the Czech embassy attempted to deliver to the coordinator of Cuban affairs in the Department of State a written note from the Cuban government on the question of the detention of the vessels and crews. The coordinator, quite properly, refused to accept the note because of its gross distortion of the facts and its highly offensive language. The note did not refer to the action already taken by the Cuban government against the water supply of the naval base. Now, let me say that we have noticed Cuban broadcasts which suggest a concerted campaign against our presence in Guantanamo. The basic fact is that we are in Guantanamo and will remain there for the foreseeable future. Those arrangements cannot be abrogated except with the consent of both parties. And we shall certainly not discuss the future of Guantanamo with a regime which does not speak for the Cuban people, which has been unanimously condemned by the governments of this hemisphere, and which demonstrates both in words and action its hostility toward its neighbors. Now, there are some aspects of this matter on which those of us who advise the president have asked for further investigation and information. We shall be meeting later in the day with the president, and there may be further announcements to be made on this matter at that time. What I've tried to do today is to straighten out the factual background, to make it quite clear that these exaggerated and extraordinary and violent charges about seizing vessels in international waters are wholly unfounded, and we will not link the handling of these fishing vessels under the normal processes of American law with the question of water supply in Guantanamo, and that we are in Guantanamo and shall remain there. Now, gentlemen, I've talked at some length, but I'll be glad to take some questions.
Mr. Secretary, yes. There are indications from what you have said and from the circumstances that this was a deliberate provocation, the entering of international waters. Whether it was or not, why do you think that Castro should have chosen this particular time to play one of the few nonviolent cards that he had left in the game?
Well, I think that in view of what I've said about certain points needing further examination and information, that I ought not to add to what I've said along that line today. Perhaps we can later in the day.
Mr. Secretary, do you see this in terms of an international situation at this at the present time, ranging beyond the Cuban-United States relationship in this affair?
I think that will depend on what is in the background. I would suppose that when the Cuban government elected not to let this question of the fishing boats be handled in the normal way in which such incidents are handled in many countries over a period of a year, it wanted to broaden the base of the dispute and of the tension. But I would not wish to speculate in detail on that at the present moment.
Secretary, to go to the other side of the world, Vietnam, the President suggested last week that there might be circumstances under which the United States would approve of the neutralization of both North and South Vietnam. He did not have time or did not spell this out. Would you tell us what is the policy of the United States in that respect?
Well, let's start from the most elementary aspects of that problem. When the Geneva Conference on Laos convened 1961-62, I made a statement at that time that the only problem of peace in Southeast Asia arose from the North. There was no threat to the peace of Southeast Asia from the South or from across the Pacific. That if those in the North would leave their neighbors alone, there could be peace. If the agreements which have already been reached and which have been signed by those in the North would be fulfilled, there could be peace in Southeast Asia. Now, we know that the other side has no present intention of talking about the neutralization of North Korea, North Vietnam. Were they to make any such proposal, that at least would inject something new into the situation. But what we cannot accept is the idea that while they disregard their solemn commitments and move to undermine the Geneva Accords of 1954 as well as of 1962, that somehow we neutralize South Vietnam, meaning presumably by that withdrawing American forces and pulling out support so that South Vietnam would be even more exposed to the kinds of penetration which have been aimed at Southeast Asia from the North for these past few years. That is simply a device for the communization of all of Southeast Asia, and that we cannot accept. Now, I think we ought to go back to the basic point that existing agreements ought to be observed. And if they would be observed, then the way is open for peace in Southeast Asia.
Mr. Secretary, what do you regard as being the consequences then of the proposal set forth by President de Gaulle? Are they severely damaging or not?
Well, there is some uncertainty about just what those proposals are, because there have been some statements made, but no detailed proposals of which I'm aware. It was indicated at one point some months ago that the reference to a neutralized Southeast Asia was intended to be a reference to a very long-term solution, that it did not have operational impact upon the immediate situation because of the attitude of the communist world. And I don't know of any other proposals or any more precise proposals that have been made.
Mr. Secretary, in that connection, has there been any talk specifically of a treaty for the neutralization of Southeast Asia? There's been talk about the neutralization of Cambodia, in which a certain number of nations would participate to guarantee it, but is this what de Gaulle has in mind?
I don't know what they might have in mind in Paris. My own thought on that would be that if these existing agreements were to be lived up to, if they were to be performed, this question wouldn't even arise. Because these states of Southeast Asia would then be independent, secure, and free to pursue their own policy. And there would be no problem of disengagement from an alliance on the part of, say, a country like Laos or Cambodia or South Vietnam, who are not allies, and who would have to themselves to invoke the protocol of CETO before CETO would become applicable, so that what they need is a chance to pursue their own policy as independent countries. And that is what they do not have so long as they're under this pressure from the North.
Mr. Secretary, just to set the record straight, when you use the term North, are you speaking of the government in Hanoi, the government in Peking, the government in Moscow, or
I'm thinking of all three of them, but in what relative weights, I would not want to be mathematical. Certainly Hanoi and Peiping are fully behind these aggressive pressures that are going on in Southeast Asia. We would be glad to see the Soviet Union more active in itself, throwing its full weight behind the performance on the existing accords. But I think all three of them carry a heavy responsibility in this regard.
Let me see. Mr. Secretary, going from the fishing to the hunting license, with the recent developments in Eastern Europe, how would you assess the present state of affairs between Eastern European countries and the United States?
Well, if you look at the Eastern European countries generally, I would say that there are some important differences between us, particularly on these world problems and the problems of confrontation. But nevertheless, we do believe that there should be a continuing exploration of points of possible agreement. This exploration should be on small points as well as large points. We have been encouraged to believe that there can be improvement in relations between Eastern Europe and Western Europe and the United States, and that some improvements have indeed been going on, and we welcome those. Because we do believe that it is important that this search for peace be never ending, and that if we fail in that search for peace, it will not be through inattention or lack of diligence or lack of a desire to find agreements based upon the genuine common interests of the two sides. So I would say that this is a probing period. There is a desire on our side to improve these relations. We feel that there is some desire on the other side to do the same, and we would like to see some of these points move toward more agreement.
In addition to that, would you recommend the constant and continuous usage of the word satellites, or would you rather restrict that word to describing, for instance, heavenly bodies alone?
Well, I think that in a formal statement, I believe that one of my colleagues in Eastern Europe once said that I should always refer to them as socialist countries. I would say in a formal statement, the socialist countries of Eastern Europe, and let you decide who would be satellite and who the central mass, but I wouldn't pursue that point at the moment.
Back to Vietnam for a moment. As you know, the communists have scored some gains there recently. This has led some people to wonder whether the Vietnamese government, aided by the United States, can win this battle militarily. How do you assess the present military situation and the role of the new government in the days ahead?
I think the resources and the capabilities are there to get this job done. On the present basis of assistance to the Vietnamese so that they themselves can handle this problem primarily with their own effort. There has been, as you know, the political unsettlement in South Vietnam since last November. I understand that we may be hearing about a new government, the actual construction of the new government in the next day or two from Saigon. We do know that the leadership is determined to prosecute this war with full vigor. We see no significant relaxation of the desire of the Vietnamese themselves to free themselves from these penetrations from outside and the disorder and the insecurity existing within the country. So although I cannot predict to you what the events of the next three or four weeks might mean, I have no doubt myself about the longer-range outcome of that situation.
Mr. Secretary, what meaning do you see in the motion of the Vietnam in the circumstance that, as you charge here, the Cuban government purposely provoked an incident with the United States, and with some evidence that it was supported in this by the Soviet Union?
Well, I wouldn't want to base my answer on the assumptions underlying your question at this point. I think these are matters that we need to have further information about. However, I have said to many of you, perhaps at a press conference as well, that we're not in a detente. And in a general sense, we made certain significant but limited steps. We've had the hotline, the nuclear test ban treaty, the resolution of the United Nations on bombs in orbit. We've agreed on certain principles applied to outer space. We're increasing our cooperation in outer space. We've sold some wheat. But these big and dangerous and explosive issues are still in front of us. Mr. Khrushchev has said there's no ideological detente, or there's no ideological coexistence. These basic purposes remain the same. There is somewhat more caution, perhaps, about the degree of militancy with which some of these goals are pursued. At least in the European side of the communist world, Beijing is pushing the more militant line in doctrine and perhaps also in action. But I would not myself subscribe to the view that there is a detente. I had commented earlier that there is an atmosphere of detente which is causing some complications. I think there is an impression in some people's minds that the detente has gone much further than it has. Now, we would like to achieve a relaxation of tensions. We'd like to get far more far-reaching agreements. We'd like to stabilize peace by real assurance about what the future can hold. We're not there yet. We're not there yet. We're going to have to work at it week after week with a lot of effort on our part, a lot of patience, a lot of determination, and with the complete cooperation and unity of the Allies and the sober understanding and readiness to communicate on the part of the leaders of the communist world.
I wonder, Mr. Secretary, whether you could tell us where the Cyprus situation now stands, and if the fighting really gets worse there, whether the international force will still remain the best means of dealing with the situation, or whether you expect the British government to deal with the situation.
Well, I think that today, and this is one of the troubles with press conferences, they happen on specific days, that today, I shouldn't say too much about that. As you know, we've made some proposals to the interested governments. We ourselves had felt for a period of months, as you know, that the primary responsibility in this matter was for the government of Cyprus, the authorities on Cyprus, and the three guarantor powers. Then there came a moment when it appeared that some new element would have to be injected into the situation if an agreement could be reached. And one strong suggestion from those involved was that the presence of forces from other countries might assist, because Britain, Greece, and Turkey, who have forces on the island, had long connections with the problem and perhaps had some special difficulties in relation to it. Well, on that basis, if our friends felt that our contribution toward an international force in which we would be a junior partner would be helpful, we were prepared to entertain that, but on the basis that this would be acceptable to all those involved.
With that final comment, Secretary Rusk closed his leather-bound notebook, which gives him a handy reference for answering questions about the world's crisis areas, and then went back to his desk. As you've heard, Cuba and Guantanamo dominated the session, but again, Mr. Rusk was confronted, as he has been frequently of late, by questions about neutralizing all of Southeast Asia, in keeping with the concept now openly advocated by France's General de Gaulle. Mr. Rusk tried again to scotch any such idea, but it's clear that he'll have to speak out even more forcefully than he did today to reassure most Asians. This has been a special program by ABC News of the highlights of Secretary Rusk's news conference. This is John Scalley, ABC Washington.
On the line with Considine weekdays on the ABC Radio Network.